When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at Remarkable.com today.
Did you know that many products for pregnant women do not have their own clinical trials for safety or efficacy? That's because pregnant women are often excluded from clinical studies. Ritual is aiming to set a new standard with their essential prenatal multivitamin. It's the number one best-selling prenatal and the only leading prenatal backed by its own human clinical trial. Essential Prenatal is proven to deliver key nutrients, including folate, biotin, and vitamin D during pregnancy. Moms taking Essential Prenatal had a lower overall cortisol level during pregnancy than those taking a leading prenatal. Plus, it's designed to be gentle on the stomach. Ritual doesn't just have your back. They have the receipts. Get 25% off at ritual.com/clinical. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Coming up on this week's show, the retro secrets in the new Call of Duty game.
Playing your Switch with an Atari joystick.
And we talk to Tim Gilberts, the author of The Quill.
The Retro Owl podcast is brought to you with our amazing mates at Bitmap Books, and we're going to be telling you about their brilliant new Game Boy box art collection very soon.
And stay listening for an amazing offer on Retro Gamer magazine.
Hello and welcome to the Retro Owl podcast, episode number 251, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And a very warm welcome to this week's show. Now, we thought we'd give you a nice little welcome if you are a new listener as well, because I imagine we've had quite a lot of people who are checking out the show for the first time over the last couple of weeks. As, of course, the way the show works is we bring you a guest on the second half, and we'll tell you more about that because we've got a great one this week. But in the first 20 minutes or so, we recap on the big retro gaming stories of the week. And when we've been looking around for retro gaming stories, the news from the last 7 days, we seem to come up quite a lot in the last week.
Yeah, I was looking at the news this morning. So we have an Excel spreadsheet that we all share, and we all put our news that we spotted in the week. And I'm Googling stuff, and I keep seeing about this amazing bug that's been discovered in the Dreamcast after 20 years. It's exclusive from John Bird. And I keep clicking on it, and I'm like, that was our guest last week. This is our news. But it was really cool to see, because we've been doing this now for 5 years, 251 episodes, like you say. And we're the news. Like, I mean, obviously, we're not like the main news. Like, oh my God. But it was just interesting to see us on some news articles and stuff. And it was just really cool. And it's, you know, a few people reached out to us and said how cool it was to get that exclusive.
It was interesting because I'd been working on that episode with John for a while. And yeah. John actually wrote it in like a kind of storyboard form. Mm. And like he narrated it. It was like somebody told me it sounded like a murder investigation. or like a kind of crime filler, thriller going on, basically. And
an audiobook.
And I was wondering, how's this going to go down with listeners? And the funny thing was, when it came out, a few people were going, what bug is it? Tell me which bug it is. And it's like, well, if you listen, it's one that's not been discussed before. And it turns out people had actually listened. And, you know, we went on to Nintendo Life. Thanks so much, Nintendo Life. We love you. And we're always covering your stories as well. So it's really good to be on a site that we actually get the news from. It's mad, really.
I love the amount of tweets that we had during the week as well from people that are like, oh, I didn't know about this podcast. I'll check it out. It's really interesting. I'm going to listen every week now. So if you were one of those, great to have you on board. And of course, if you have been a listener for many years, which I know a lot of people have, great to have you back for another episode. Now, today, we are going to be talking about something really old school, going back to the ZX81 and the Speccy days, and covering a topic that we've just been loving recently. It's adventure game time again, Ravi.
Yeah, I think I'm obsessed with adventure games at the moment. We've had so many guests on. And this week is no different. We've got Tim Gilberts on. Now, Tim Gilberts is an author of The Quill. You think about stuff today like Unity, there was the arcade game design tools. There was all these games that were created so people could create games. And The Quill was a text adventure-based one. So, you know, it enabled users to create their own text adventures. A title came out from that. But also, you know, Tim, he was like 16 when he started this. It was a real family business, Britsoft style. And also, he talks about schools in the 70s and what was available in the schools at the time. Because we all went to school, we had the BBCs, we had the Acorns in the UK at least. And we know there was a lot of Apple in America. Well, Tim tells us what was going on in the 70s with teleprinters and mainframes and all that fun stuff.
Yeah, I love hearing the stories about, you know, like playing text adventure games on teletypes, which I've actually seen in person, you know, the Retro Computer Museum in Leicester. We'll talk more about that in the interview, but it's a really interesting one, this, because like you said, he was 16 years old. Him and his dad founded this company, Gilsoft, became, you know, a really big publisher, particularly on the ZX81 and the Spectrum, and also got into a lot of other stuff as well, like they did, like, you know, clones of arcade games, and today he's actually working on the Spectrum Next as well. So it's just a really good nostalgic chat. I mean, we do obviously talk a lot about adventure games, but even just in general, I think anyone that wants a really good insight into what was happening in Britain in particular back in the late 70s, early 80s, and you're going to get loads out of this one.
There's a new system called Adventuron, which is a text game creation kind of tool. We talk about that, but we had to go back and talk about the original, which was The Quill.
Yeah, absolutely. So The Quill, I mean, again, like you said, it just made writing text adventure games back then easy. Because, I mean, I mentioned it in the interview. I had a go at writing a text adventure with my friend, thinking that, you know, oh, this is going to be easy. You don't need graphics or anything. It's just text. And then we kind of got, you know, by the time we'd interweaved all the different things a player could do and all the different paths and all the things they'd ask, I mean, it just got into a complete mess. And I think we gave up on it at the end. You know, we'd really overstretched ourselves. But it just opened it up to everyone. So Tim Gilberts is going to be our special guest talking about The Quill and Gilsoft very soon on the Retro Hour podcast. Now, we have got some really good news stories to talk about this week. Before we do, let's give a huge welcome to one of our favorite publishers in the world, our amazing friends at Bitmap Books, who are back on board bringing you the Retro Hour podcast this week. We love working with Bitmap Books, don't we?
Yeah, I absolutely love Bitmap Books. We've worked with them a few times before, and we've been really lucky because they've sent us out some free copies of their books in the past, and they're just amazing quality. They're just like, they're the type of thing, you know, I've said it before, I'll say it again, sometimes for Christmas, I'm a big retro game, and my mum might buy me one of these little silly retro game, you know, arcade things from, you know, from Argos or something. But honestly, I would much rather a Bitmap Book. They're absolutely amazing books, these are, and I'm so thrilled that we're sponsored by them again.
Well, this one's especially for you, Joe, as well, because it's the Game Boy box art collection. And yeah, we all know you're the big Game Boy fan, but also, did you keep any of those boxes, or were they all trash straight away?
They were all trashed by my mum to bring her up again, funny enough. It's her birthday today as well, so I keep talking about her. But yeah, she did trash my boxes when I was a kid. So I need to get my hands on this new Game Boy box art collection book to relive my childhood and just, you know, kind of look at those box arts and just remember what was thrown in the bin all those years ago.
I mean, if you haven't seen a Bitmap Books book before, I've got a few on the shelf, and whenever my friends come round, you know, even people that are not video game fans, you always, like, you know, it always grabs their attention. They always pull it out and have a look through it because they're beautifully made, and they really are a celebration of video games like this one. I mean, if you're an old school Game Boy fan like Joe, or maybe you're just getting into the system recently, the Game Boy Box Art Collection is a celebration of some of the finest cover artwork for the monochrome Marvel, which of course was really the kickstart of the handheld games industry for a lot of people, wasn't it?
Yeah, the Game Boy was the introduction, but also, like I said, a lot of people would get loose carts. There'd be a whole second-hand market. So to see some of this box art, you know, I've never seen it myself before. And it's just absolutely fantastic to see some of these boxes, but also the quality and the kind of printing that they have them in. It's a really nice way of displaying it, but also it's in a cute little book as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's beautifully made, but also what they've done is they've actually worked closely with some of the world's biggest Game Boy collectors, and they've put together a really varied selection of titles that span both the Eastern and the Western releases. So what you're going to get is, I mean, they've actually translated some of the Japanese titles for the first time, and they give you, like, screenshots on each page. You can actually see what the games look like too, and it's 372 pages long. Game Boy, the Box Art Collection, is also available in a few different editions if you're a bit of a collector as well. There are silver and gold editions with an exclusive cover illustration from Super Play and Rare legend Will Overton, which you also get an A2 poster, a sturdy metal box. These are limited in numbers as well, so if you are a collector, you need to get your hands on this. And you can pre-order your copy right now of Game Boy, the Box Art Collection, by heading to the website bitmapbooks.co.uk, and please show a bit of love to our amazing friends at Bitmap Books. Now let's get into this week's news stories. The first one, Joe, the new Call of Duty game. What?
Yeah, so we've got a modern game on the show. Turn the show off.
I did not even know that there was a new Call of Duty game, but I knew that Dan would buy it.
You know what? You know, it's right here.
Yeah, oh, really?
I did every year.
There we go.
He's always let down.
I haven't picked it up yet. And I knew it was out. I knew it was coming out. And I usually pick Call of Duty up every 2 or 3 years because I do like them. And I usually try to make sure I pick one of the ones with zombies mode on. And I've messed up this year because if I bought last year's and it didn't have zombies and this year's had zombies. But we're not here to talk about Call of Duty and we're not here to talk about zombies. We're here to talk about the retro arcade machines in the new Call of Duty Black Ops Cold War. So I read this morning, which I thought was really cool. And it's a bit of a throwback to the first Black Ops game because obviously you had the, is it Zork in that one?
Yeah.
Yeah. In this one, essentially, from what I understand, in the main campaign, you have a safe house. And as you play through the campaign, each level, you can find arcade machines in, like, you know, like the burnt out buildings and stuff like that. And as you find them, they become playable in your safe house. So there's 10 playable arcade games in there with the full game. So you get Pitfall 2, you get Enduro, Brainstorming, Pitfall 1, River Raid, Grand Prix, Fishing Derby, Boxing, Kaboom, and Chopper Command, all in your safe house, which I thought was insane. So it's not just one game, you've got 10 games this time.
It's interesting. It's kind of like Inception, isn't it? A game inside a game.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I remember Duke Nukem 3D, and I think it had a copy of Wolfenstein in there.
Yeah.
You'd go up and you'd play one of the arcade machines. But also I'm thinking of, like we mentioned the other day, loading screens with, you know, the Namco ones where they had Space Invaders loading up for Gallagher. That was it for Ridge Racer, yeah.
This is cool as well because, I mean, these are all obviously Activision games.
Mm.
And I think they're all Atari 2600 games.
Yeah, I think they are,
Yeah, they've kind of gone back to their roots. So it is cool. I mean, boxing, I have played that on the Atari 2600. That's kind of that overhead boxing game.
And their arms just go out straight and they've got like, I feel like they've got big noses, like from above. Yeah. So yeah, it was interesting to see that, yeah.
Yeah, and you got obviously Kaboom as well. That was kind of where a guy drops bombs on you and you got to kind of avoid it.
Mm.
Chopper Command, that was Bob Whitehead. That was kind of like Defender in the desert. So some of these games, I mean, you know, for Atari 2600 games, Activision generally did a lot of the best games on that platform. So if you want a bit of distraction from the latest Call of Duty game, I've played the online. I haven't actually got into the campaign yet. So
do you ever play the campaign? Do you just play
some
online?
Some years I do. Yeah, I mean, generally I just do the online stuff really, but because I mean, you know, Call of Duty, again, it's one of these games that I hate myself for buying it every year. Because every year I'm like, it's kind of the FIFA of first-person shooters, isn't it?
And you're just like, shall I buy it? And then I do it. I won't buy it. I wasn't going to buy it last year because it didn't have zombies. And then I'm like, oh, my friends are playing it and they're all playing it online. So I get it. And I'm never ready to move on because I don't play it like every night or anything. I just play it every now and then. And now the new one's out. And I'm like, I've not finished the other one. Like, I'd still play that one. Like,
oh, it's
this is cool.
It's interesting that they've got Pitfall 2 in there as well, because Pitfall was like a huge game. David Crane designed it, and it was, you know, one of Activision's massive titles, and to be honest, it's the only title I recognise out of that list.
Yeah, I mean, the second game was like really advanced for the 2600 as well. I just imagine that my brother messaging me, how far have you got with the campaign then? Are you playing it? I'm like, yeah, just
I'm on level three of Pitfall.
So if you have got
I've bought this £50 game and all I'm doing is playing Pitfall 2.
That is so me. So if you do want to unlock those hidden arcade games in the new Call of Duty game, I'll put a link to the article. You can see how to get them all in our show notes at theretrohour.com. Maybe you want to go old school on your Switch as well, because we were talking last week about how the Switch is one of our favourite platforms for retro games, but obviously playing them with the Joy-Con controllers doesn't always feel that authentic, but doing it with an original Atari joystick...
Yeah, I mean, my first question is, does it have drift? You know, that's the first thing I'm thinking of, but no, jokes aside. Yeah, funny, once again, we're talking about Atari, but a YouTuber, Will It Work, has done this. He's got an original Atari 2600 controller, the Atari...
CX-10.
He's got the CX-40, I believe it is.
Oh, the later one.
That was my teething joystick. You know, there I told you years ago, I used to chew on a joystick when I was a baby. That was the one.
Well, he's got the very one that Ravi used to chew on. He's got it connected up to his Switch, and he's been playing Breath of the Wild with it, which I think is absolutely amazing. But what I love about this was, when I first saw this, I thought, oh, here we go. There's going to be some soldering magic here. He's taken it apart. He's got it, you know, Frankenstein monsters hardwired into the Switch. But actually, Ravi was telling me how easy this is for people to go out there and do it themselves.
Yeah, this is crazy. It's just done with adapters, essentially. And there's one called from Rafnet here, which is a D-Sub one. So it's essentially Genesis, Sega Master System, Atari. You can probably have your Amiga stuff on there. And this connects with your Wii or GameCube. So... you know those GameCube controller ports that you had?
Yes.
It connects with that. So also, I suspect this probably works with the Wii U if you have the adapter for it, the GameCube controllers. Now, this is only £30. Already, that is an awesome thing, but it's out of stock, of course. Everybody wants one after seeing this video. But what they have done to make it work on the Switch is they've got a wireless adapter for the Switch, which I've never seen this before. It's by... 8-bit do. It's called the G-Bros wireless adapter for the Switch, and it's just this little unit that looks like it's powered by USB, and you just plug the controller straight into there. So he's plugged one adapter into another adapter, and it's all mapped it, and he's daisy chained them, but also you can map the buttons.
So essentially he's using... where some people, because we've got all these competitive players and stuff who use GameCube controllers with Smash Bros on the Switch, but he's essentially daisy-chained another one that converts it to the Atari one.
Yeah. So he's got this D-Sub one, which is amazing. I did not know you can get these controllers. And like a lot of people have said to me, oh, the GameCube controllers are the best on this system. But, oh, man. I can imagine playing it with an old Mega Drive pad or something. That could be so cool. So I really want to see these Rafnet devices, you know, being made available again.
You know, they are saying in the article that you just play Zelda Breath of the Wild in there as well, which obviously you've only got one fire button on the Atari joystick. Luckily, you can remap it, but it said, you know, if you are playing that, you're going to have to keep going in and remapping it to the different things that you want to
do. It'll be like Street Fighter on the Amiga, where you've got to do like one button, up, down, left, right. All these crazy combos.
Yeah, it doesn't sound the most practical way to play games like that, but they do also point out as well that, you know, for there is a lot of retro games on the Switch, for example, playing something like Donkey Kong, if you're playing that with like a CX-10 or a CX-40 Atari stick, that is a bit more akin to playing the original arcade version of the game.
Yeah, imagine Tropical Freeze with that, or like, there'd be some fantastic titles. Like, I can imagine playing the Street Fighter with the original Mega Drive pads or something like that would really bring back some nostalgia.
So if you want to watch his video, I actually love the stuff that he covers on his channel as well. I mean, another video that he did recently was hooking up an iOmega Zip Drive to an Apple Watch.
Oh, wow.
So, I think you'll enjoy it. I'll put a link to that in our show notes as well at theretrohour.com. Now, Worms, obviously, that's a title that we love. I mean, I think we're all fans of Worms on the show, aren't we?
Oh, yep. Huge, huge Worms fan, yeah. One of the best titles ever, I think.
Well, tell us about this new collection then that's coming to the Evercade.
Yeah, so the Evercade is a little machine, and the nice thing about the Evercade is they release these collections. So you get it in cartridges, and you get like three or four titles with them. Now, they've done a deal with Team 17, and Team 17 own all the Worms franchise. I think for about a couple of years, all Team 17 did was produce bloody Worms titles until they actually got onto the indie game and came up with some new stuff. But they have got some of the best Worms titles here. So they've got the original Worms, and they've got Worms Armageddon. And now Armageddon is just an absolutely beautiful game. I wonder if it's going to come with all the extra DLC and all the fan-made content already put in there. And then they've got Worms Blast. And Worms Blast is, it's nothing like the original Worms franchise. It's essentially Bubble Bobble and puzzles games in the kind of Worms world. But there was tons that came out. There was Worms Golf. There was Worms Fishing. Probably Worms Mall or something. I don't know.
Was Worms Blast a GameCube game? I do vividly remember it.
I think so. It passed me by, but I remember seeing it.
I wasn't sure which one Worms Blast was. I thought it might have been the one that came out when the Xbox One came out, and it was like built into it or something. I thought it might have been one of the more modern ones, but I think Rabbit.
Yeah, well, no, that was
the
WMD,
recent one was WMD, and that would have been really nice to kind of put in there. But I don't know if the hardware would have been able to take WMD because there's a lot of effects.
But this is all coming on one cartridge for the Evercade, is it?
Yeah, so three games on one cartridge. You've got Armageddon in there as well. And yeah, just Armageddon alone I would get. But I don't know how well it's going to work on that tiny screen.
Yeah, because it's only a little screen, isn't it? And this is coming out in May 2021. And pre-orders are opening this week, I believe, for it, which is cool. And it's usually quite cheap, isn't it, the game? So they're usually only like £15 for the collections, aren't they?
Yeah, it's a nice little deal. And, you know, I kind of like it, actually, having this choice of selections rather than just a big ton of ROMs that you're constantly scrolling through and you can't kind of make a decision, you know? Sometimes it's nice to have a curated collection for you.
And I like the fact they've got the original Worms in there, because that was the one that I spent a lot of time on as a kid. But the one I really liked that I wish was on here is Director's Cut.
Yeah, you'll never get DC on any other platform but the Amiga.
Yeah, which is, it's a shame. I mean, it's cool having an Amiga exclusive, because that title was kind of a goodbye to the Amiga from Team 17.
Well, essentially, Armageddon is DC. It's like DC with a bit more upgraded graphics. All of the weapons that were on DC went onto Armageddon and stuff. So it was really the testing ground before that.
Well, let's talk about the new Super Mario Game & Watch. Now, we covered this when it first got announced a while ago. People are finally starting to get them in their hands right now. And our friend Adam, he's been showing me his Game & Watch on Facebook over the last couple of days. Looks a really nice little machine. But even before this was released last Friday, some people managed to get their hands on it a little bit early. And, of course, it was hacked straight away.
Yeah, so a hacker named Stack Smashing got his hands on this a couple of days before it actually came out, because some of them were actually sent out early. And essentially what he did, I'm no hacker, Ravi usually knows a little bit more about these things, but from what I understand, just to put it in simpleton terms, he has hacked it, taken it apart, and essentially he has got past the Nintendo loading screen, which is essentially, that was actually the security of the Game & Watch. That was actually to stop it from people hacking it and stuff, and he's got round it. And essentially the first thing he's done is he's found that it is ROMs on there, which is now leading us to think, are we actually going to be able to hack this and get a portable Nintendo system, which would be really
cool. Because it's NES ROMs it runs.
Yeah, because it's running NES ROMs on there. So essentially his question is, are we going to be able to put some ROMs on here and get it, you know, running ROMs as a handheld, which would be really cool. But he's also, interestingly, there's actually been a language glitch in it, which we haven't covered, but apparently they were shipped with a language error in there. And that was the first thing he did. He fixed the language error in the English for it. rather than it coming up, what's quite funny is rather than it coming up with the Nintendo logo when you boot it up, it now comes up with the hacked logo, which I thought was quite cool.
Yeah, because the Game & Watch, I mean, it's a lovely little form factor. And these new ones, I mean, they're ARM processor-based. Looking at the amount of memory you've got on there, I mean, it looks like, apparently there's 128K of flash memory, and you've got essentially about a megabyte of RAM on there as well, which obviously is going to be enough to run pretty much any NES game, I imagine. Storing them on there, though, I imagine is going to be a different thing. You're not going to get too many on with that kind
of
room.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, I was bigging it up a little bit there, but I was like, actually, are we only going to be able to fit like one or two games on this? But
yeah.
Is it going to run Doom?
Well, they're saying here at the moment that they're basically, it's got basic security, which is preventing the firmware from being dumped.
Mm.
So the thing is, he's probably got this one version hacked, but he can't create a firmware yet.
Oh, okay.
This is yet that can go out to all the other people. Now, the way that it works is the NES ROM actually gets dumped into the RAM. And then people can play them. So the RAM's probably going to be really small, but maybe there'll be a way of having an external device or something that's just going to like have some custom firmware on it and flash the RAM every time you reset it. And you could put a new ROM on there, or it can become a little kind of NES, essentially.
I mean, there have been other solutions, you know, for systems in the past where it's essentially like a card where you reflash it with every game that you want to play. So I imagine maybe you can load the NES game via, you know, a laptop or something, just kind of send it down to the game and watch every time you want to play something.
It's like a race now, though, isn't it? It's like, you know, with piracy, when someone's like, I've cracked that first. Now it's like, I've hacked the mini console first. And there must be guys sitting there waiting for these to come out, pre-ordered them, just sitting there with all their tools ready to take it apart and completely destroy it.
And I think Joe's just set out a challenge there to get Doom running on this thing.
Yeah, I
have. Oh, yeah, that's going to be Doom next.
I think you can run Doom on a toothbrush now. It's on like everything.
Yeah, I think we covered it on a pregnancy test, didn't we?
And there is actually a couple of demos. I think people have got it running on an NES, so I imagine it will be quite simple to get working on this thing. But if you're finding the games maybe a little bit too hard, because, you know, we were talking the other week actually about how you often, you know, play a game that you haven't played for a long time and you're like, God, how did I ever get so far on this back in the day? Well, there is actually a couple of hidden cheat modes inside the new Game & Watch as well.
Yeah, this one made me laugh. So I was reading this article and it was like, you know, the hidden secrets of the Nintendo Super Mario Bros. Game & Watch. And I was like, oh, wow, like there's going to be like a Konami code. Obviously, it's Nintendo, but there's going to be something along there in there. It's going to be really cool. But apparently when you start up Super Mario Bros. Or Super Mario Bros. Last Levels, hold the A button. It'll give you infinite lives. So I was like, well, that's not too hard to find. So, but apparently if infinite lives isn't your thing, if you go to play the ball game on there and you don't want to play as Mario, hold the A button on there and you can play as Luigi as well, which I thought was pretty cool.
I love the fact we've got a very Namrud in Joe.
It's interesting that they do put this stuff in, though.
Yeah.
It's really cool, and I reckon there might be more that get discovered in the future.
Yeah.
Maybe a nude Mario cheat or something.
Play as Lara Croft. Well, interesting you should say that. There is apparently 35 special events built into the digital clock as well. The article here on Nintendo Life only lists off a couple of them, but if you boot it up at 7 o'clock in the morning or in the evening, Monty Mole will appear from the ground and run around on the title screen. 11 minutes past one, three bloopers appear and swim up and out of the screen. And at 5:55, the blocks turn into coins. This is all on the clock, sorry, not on the title screen. But apparently there's 35 of them in there, which is really cool. So yeah, there's quite a lot of Easter eggs to be discovered in the little Game & Watch. You know, for something which is meant to be just like a little, you know, oh, here's the new Game & Watch, it plays Mario Bros. Kind of thing. It's got quite a lot going on it, I think.
We've not heard about any Game Gear ones, have we? So
no, yeah. That's true. Yeah, that's really true, actually. A little bit of a chip at Sega there.
Yeah, you might have unlocked something on the mini Game Gear, but chances are you probably can't see it. Because
what have I unlocked? Get the microscope.
But yeah, I agree with you. I think, you know, the fact that Nintendo didn't just dump a ROM on here and that's it, put it out. They've actually gone to the effort of putting some nice little secrets in there for the fans. That's pretty cool, I think. So we'll put that. And of course, everything else we talked about this week, you'll find in our show notes at theretrohour.com. Now, before we get into our interview this week, talking about the Quill Classic Adventure Games with our guest, Tim Gilberts, he's coming up in just a moment. Let's give a huge thank you to another big supporter of the Retro Hour podcast, and this is our brilliant friends at Retro Gamer Magazine, that of course is brought to you by the legendary Future Publishing. Now, at the moment, without getting too modern, a lot of the world is celebrating the dawn of a new console generation. PlayStation 5 and Xbox X are out now as well. But Future Publishing are not only celebrating that, but also thanking those of us who still remember the original ones as well and showing them a bit of love. Now, we've got an amazing offer where you can subscribe to save 95% on the price and get 3 issues of Retro Gamer magazine for just £1.
That's awesome.
How many people have we had tweeting us going, what are you going to be doing the
£1
offer?
Yeah, I've had so many people like, right, when have you got the deals back on? And it's back on, guys. This is absolutely fantastic. You can get 3 issues for £1. Free.
Now, this is exclusively for listeners of the Retro Hour podcast, and it's available actually on all of Future Magazine's gaming mags. Of course, Retro Gamer, but also official PlayStation, Edge, PC Gamer as well. And I'm looking actually at the latest edition of Retro Gamer magazine here. There's a massive cover feature on Prince of Persia, The Sands of Time, which was a really good game, actually. I don't know if you guys ever played that back in the day.
Was that for the GameCube?
Yeah, 2003 this one came out. So this was
a lot of running on the walls, I remember that.
Yeah, it kind of took Prince of Persia in a different direction. And they've got Patrice Desilets, I believe you pronounce his name, the guy who actually made that version, but also Jordan Mechner's in here too. So they're both kind of giving their input into the Prince of Persia franchise and that game in particular. And it's actually an 8-page feature. And they talk about all the different Prince of Persia games over the years as well. There's also an interview here with Andrew Braybrook as well, talking about Gribbley's Day Out, Fire and Ice in here as well. There's loads of stuff. Turrican. They're talking about a lot of classic Amiga games that I loved back in the day. There's a look at the Gemini arcade system by Coleco, which I don't think I've ever seen one of those before.
I've never heard of the Gemini. And also, just looking at this as well, Edge magazine. I really need to read Edge because I know nothing about the modern consoles, and they've got a full look at the two new big consoles that have come out, and I'm completely clueless. I need to check that out as well.
That's the thing, a lot of people at the moment are like, should I buy a PlayStation 5 or an Xbox X? I mean, obviously Edge magazine, very trusted name for many years now. So if you want to make up your mind, if you're going to be getting a new console, you can check that out as well. Now, we've got this amazing offer. Get 3 issues of your favourite Future Publishing gaming magazine with this exclusive Retro Hour offer. And claim this now, because you know, we get people tweeting us in like 3 or 4 months, oh, I missed it. Make sure you do it right now. All you've got to do is head to this website, magazinesdirect.com/Retro Hour. So that's saving up to 95% on official PlayStation magazine, Retro Gamer, Edge, or PC Gamer by heading to the website right now, magazinesdirect.com/Retro Gamer. And I'll put that in our show notes as well. Now, of course, we do have a patron. We're getting ready to record our second episode, actually, our third episode now, doing interviews for our patrons only exclusive podcast. You guys are going to give me a bit of a grilling.
Can't wait. Yeah, and we're also going to be doing our patrons meetup, and if you support us as well, for just as little as $3.50, you can get 4 episodes of the Retro Hour ad-free as well.
Yeah, and you get them a bit early often. We put them out a few days early, so and you get the bonus podcast. You get, you know, at least 2 of those a month. So if you want to back us on Patreon, you can do that at theretrohour.com. And of course, for doing it, you will get your place in the very prestigious Retro Hour Hall of Fame. Like this week, thank you to Adam Ainsworth,
Peter Van Holland,
Andy Plucknett,
Gavin Creech,
Ben Leyland,
who all made donations into our Patreon. And if you'd like to do the same, we'd really appreciate your support. You'll find that at theretrohour.com. Right, then next, let's talk about classic adventure games with the author of The Quill and founder of Gilsoft. Tim Gilberts is our special guest next on the Retro Hour podcast.
Did you know that many products for pregnant women do not have their own clinical trials for safety or efficacy? That's because pregnant women are often excluded from clinical studies. Ritual is aiming to set a new standard with their essential prenatal multivitamin. It's the number one best-selling prenatal and the only leading prenatal backed by its own human clinical trial. Essential Prenatal is proven to deliver key nutrients, including folate, biotin, and vitamin D during pregnancy. Moms taking Essential Prenatal had a lower overall cortisol level during pregnancy than those taking a leading prenatal. Plus, it's designed to be gentle on the stomach. Ritual doesn't just have your back. They have the receipts. Get 25% off at ritual.com/clinical. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and it's time to welcome on this week's very special guest. Now, today, we're going to be talking about a topic that we've spent a lot of time talking about recently because we love it and there are so many interesting stories around it. That is, of course, adventure games. And our guest this week was actually one of the pioneers in the adventure space here in Britain, a piece of software called the Quill that we're going to talk about in a bit more detail very soon, and some really interesting new projects that he's working on at the moment, including the Spectrum Next and something that will blow your mind. A really early system that we're going to talk about in a bit as well. But let's welcome on our guest this week. Welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, Tim Gilberts. Hello, Tim.
Hi, thanks, guys. Well, this is a real honour. I've listened to your show a lot, as you'll be aware. So by accidentally clicking the button and showing I was listening to it earlier, trying to silence my iPhone. I'm not really good with modern tech, so let's see how we get on.
Oh, I really appreciate you coming on, Tim. I mean, you know, as you know, if you listen to the podcast, we always try and get a bit of your geek credentials, kind of your background of, you know, where it all began. I mean, where did your journey with computers begin then?
There's an interesting tale, that one. I'm obviously, my background is, you know, in terms of my hobbies were electronics. I mean, you know, usual things like stamp collecting and everything else you do when you're a kid. But electronics was a really big part of my life because my dad was an engineer on British Telecom. So that sort of, that was baked into me, this interest in electronics. And we used to buy all the electronics magazines. So obviously being a bit asthmatic as well, the solder used to get at my chest a lot. But we, you know, I persevered with it. I loved playing with digital electronics. I dabbled with radio amateurs and all the rest of it, and built myself a stereo, obviously so I could listen to my new Meaty Beaty Big and Bouncy album. And that was on the area. So I was sort of well aware of computing, and it was in a bit of, dad had a bit of side business as well, building 24 tuned door chimes that used the TMS 1000 processor. So we, you know, it was certainly not unfamiliar territory to me, and I kept putting off getting a computer, which I think you mentioned, there's a few that were sort of published in the magazines, and I kept putting it off and kept putting it off. And then eventually in the school, the RE teacher, Mr. Danks, and the maths teacher, Mr. Arnold, they sort of started an after-hours computing club, and they had a ZX80, one of them had got a really early one, and a TRS-80 the Mr. Danks had, and they ran this sort of club. I think they were only about five pages ahead of us. I've mentioned this before in the book on Learning Basic, and it really made me decide this is something I really want to do. It was great fun. They even lent me the book from the ZX80 to read at home, and I got a chance to play with those. And that's really where it started. Plus, I had access then as part of maths to the school RML 480Z, 380Z it was, and the online teleprinter to the ICL mainframe at County Hall of an evening if you stayed in school. So that was my first hands-on computing experiences, I suppose.
Well, schools, when we kind of turned up at school, it was a lot later. So we had like the Acorn machines that were BBC machines there previously. Yeah. You mentioned you had a teleprinter as well. Was that kind of connected to a network, and what was educational computing like in the 70s in the UK?
Right, well, I mean, in terms of access to our computing, like I said, prior to this after school club, the only thing we had was this tele-type connector with a big hand acoustic modem, and that would, you dial up, connect to the ICL mainframe at County Hall. And you could basically, it was just a text interface for those who haven't used them. It was very, very slow, 110 baud perhaps. So, you know, literally three or four characters on the screen at at a time. It's very, very poor performance. You couldn't do a lot. The main use for it was there was an educational language called Cecil. And that will become important in a minute when we start chatting about where we started. Computer education in schools instruction language. And it's basically incredibly simplistic language. It's got like eight or nine statements. You can input a number, output a number, jump if the number test is less. I think an add, and that's about it. But the idea was to teach children to code. So we had these like big coding sheets, and you'd write out your Cecil program, and they'd be sent off to be punched by one of the punch operators at County Hall, who'd submit all the kids' jobs. And about a week later, you'd get like this 132-column blue-green line paper back with all the errors where you'd made a typing error, and they copied it exactly. So it was a really slow process. The school did have this RML 380Z in 79 when we were there, but it was very limited access, and there was only one of them in this computer room. And I had BASIC on it, so you could at least, you know, learn a little bit of BASIC. As I said, very few people had access to it, though, so educational computing was really these sort of sheets in the maths class to learn a little bit of programming.
was it kind of dependent on the school? So, like, you'd have certain techie schools and you'd have, like, non-techie schools, and the equipment would be depending on whether the school wanted to spend money on it or not.
Oh, absolutely, 100%. I mean, I was lucky our school had even had an RML 380Z, you know. They didn't offer any computing courses at all, like I said, because I was in the maths were streamed then, of course. You had M1, M2, M3, and because I was in the M1 class, we got this opportunity that the teachers took it on themselves to do, to sort of provide this sort of extra thing for the kids. So, you know, when I actually went on and wanted to do my A-levels to do computing, I had to do it at the local college. And they had a bit more facilities, obviously. They had... again, another very unusual British computer, the Alpha Micro. That was a sort of multi-user system that had about four VDU terminals and a couple of teletypes in the computer room. It was in the room behind two big 8-inch floppy disks. And that ran, you could do assembler and BASIC on that. So you had a little bit more facilities there at the college, but they didn't have a huge range of computers available, but they were teaching A-level computing, obviously. I mean, you have to remember at this time, the sort of physics course I was doing at O-level was still valves, thermionic emission, You know, so we really are talking, you know, I'd had a go with the physics teacher about the fact we weren't learning transistors, which obviously I was a big hobbyist. And I actually did one of the classes for the students to see the difference between transistors and thermionic valves. So that was a bit of fun. So, you know, it was very early days, very early days.
I love the fact that you had teletypes as well, because there's just something so, like, industrial about teletypes. The last one I played with was they had one at the Leicester Retro Computer Museum.
They're
set
so
up.
Noisy, aren't they?
Oh, they were running. They were actually running a text adventure on it, and it would just print out line by line. It was amazing to watch.
And of course, if you were the last one into the computer lab at the college, you had the two teletypes on the end. And basically, like you said, it was great. It was great for a text adventure, though, you know, and ideal for line editing is hard work when you can't see what you're doing, which is so ruined today, you know, but it's great. And I've still got my little paper tape printout that I would have, because, of course, the only way to save your program would be to stream it onto the teletype. So you actually wanted a teletype terminal if you wanted to save your program off, because you'd want to print it onto the paper tape so you could take it away with you and then put it back in when you come back. Otherwise, you'd have to try and invest in an 8-inch floppy and get it inserted in a system drive by someone. So I wasn't very popular in college, because I worked out how to put up false login prompts so I could steal the admin password so I could change pages. But nice. maybe I should admit to that.
And you accidentally left it on one weekend as well, right?
Oh, that was the school one. Yeah, no, tell me about it. Because I was allowed access to the room, I was staying late one Friday night, obviously using this terminal, and you dial up, you put the modem on, it makes the phone call, and obviously you work on it, and then you hang up, and I went home, and by the time I got home, I thought, oh, crumbs, I didn't hang it up. And this is Friday night. So I had to ring the school in a mad panic, get hold of the caretaker at the time. And I was able to talk him through going in the room and unhooking the modem and disconnecting it. I dread to think what a phone bill would have been on Monday, but that would have been the end of my computing career in the school, I think.
Well, moving into your home life then, what was your first system that you got at home, and how did you convince your parents to get it for you?
Ah, right. That was in 1981, and it was a ZX81, of course. I didn't have to persuade my parents very hard to help me do things. I had a job delivering bingo cards for the Jane Hodge home. So it was like, basically, there was loads and loads of people. They had a big list, and round you traipse the streets pushing these bingo cards in National Lottery days, of course. And it was quite lucrative at times, especially around Christmas, where, you know, loads of people would, you know, very often, I think it was the only person they'd see, some of the older people, you know, I'd call on the door with the bingo card, and they'd do it, and you'd win money. And I used to do all right with tips and things. So I was able to raise a little bit of cash for my electronics hobby. So when I said, you know, I want to get, I've been saving for a ZX80 since I'd seen the one, I thinking I could afford it, because I previously previously looked at the one that Science of Cambridge did, which is the MK14. We'll probably talk about that later, but that I looked at that in the magazine and thought I could afford that. It was £50-odd for the kit. And then the ZX80 had come out and it was obviously just £100, and it was a much better computer with a screen display and a proper keyboard. I use the term proper keyboard loosely, of course, for those who know the machine. But it was basically a real machine. So I'd been saving for that ZX80, and then the ZX81 was announced and I got quite a bit of money, and Dad agreed to put the other half with it. And we sent off for the kit and built it. And of course it didn't work.
Typical.
Yeah, absolutely. But we rang Kate Sinclair, as they were then, and they said, can you put your finger on the big chip, the ULA chip? And I said, no, it burns my finger. He said, that's working all right then. It must be something else. So we sent it back to him, and there was an agonizing few weeks wait. Well, I had just had the manual to read, and came back with apparently it was a faulty Z80 chip in it, and they swapped it for me. So it wasn't that mod my fault.
They were a great company, but it was, yeah, their quality control wasn't always the highest standard, no. I must admit.
No, absolutely. I mean, building it from a kit, you know, was pretty much the end of, that was the end of the era, wasn't it? They were the last people to offer it. I think Acorn tell a story that they stopped selling the Atom as a kit. When near the final last straw was they had one in where someone had decided they didn't want to use soldering iron on it because it would they didn't think the heat would do it any good. So they sellotaped all the components in and send it back because didn't work. So I think that's the sort of tail end of the kit era for computing, and that's reality. Is Sinclair turned into an achievable reality for everybody, and Acorn did it in the educational stream and for other people as well with the Electron and the BBC. They made home computing. That between the two, you know, much as the rivalry is there between the two of them, they created an entire world of people who had access to machinery that was really locked in those little rooms at the school and the college that were accessible only to the few before.
You mentioned the language Cecil earlier. Yeah. How did that help you get into programming, and what was it? Because I've never heard anybody mention Cecil before out of all of our guests.
No, it's probably completely lost. I think it was there's a couple of us who've sort of reminisced about the product, because we think it might have been only authorities who bought ICL mainframes. We think it was probably a job submission system that was provided on the ICL mainframe. So only education authorities who had that mainframe would have that service available if they loaded it. And of course, only schools that wanted to take it would have used it. So of course, we had this thing with all the coding sheets. And like I said, very simple set of instructions, almost like an assembly language, but interpreted by the ICL mainframe to give you the bare minimum you needed to understand how a computer worked. And it was a lot of work for kids to try this and send them out. So, like I said, Mr. Danks was the RE teacher and also taught maths, and he had a TRS-80. And we were saying it'd be great if we could have a Cecil interpreter on that so you could just type it in and run the program straight away and see the output rather than having to wait for the typing to be done and the run to be done on the mainframe and then come back a week later. And it'd be much more interactive for kids in the class to see it done. So I said, oh, I reckon I'm good enough to I'd have a go at that. I wouldn't mind trying to write one. You know, I think we could do that in BASIC. So he lent me his TRS-80 to take home, which was great. And I had that for a few weeks, and I wrote a Cecil interpreter in TRS-80 BASIC, you know, with a book open on one side and knowing the language. And that's how he really was probably my first unpaid commercial programming job.
Well, obviously, you got this ZX81 at home then. And I mean, you're obviously playing 3D Monster Maze, like everyone did.
Absolutely.
What else were you doing on there then? What got you into programming it?
I was still in school, actually. I was splitting my time between college and school. So my technology project for it was based around using the ZX81. There was an article in Personal Computer World, I think, called controlling a nuclear power station with a ZX81 or something like that. I've got a copy of the article somewhere. Basically, it was just about how do you interface computers to the real world. Because obviously, much as I loved the fact I could use the computers without soldering, I still loved electronics as well. So this was an ideal opportunity to do a project that was both things at the same time. So I, as part of the project, a friend of mine, was one of these, you know, you've got to work with a colleague on a project and present a final report. We sort of researched what machines were available for output from computers, and we came up with a chart recorder there would be something we could build ourselves and interface to the ZX81. And that's what we did as our final technology project. We built this Arrow Meccano with a main stepper motor. Thinking back, the safety issues must have been horrendous, really. But it was hooked up. I bought a kit, I think, from Maplin's that was a little I/O card for the ZX81, which you had to do some pokes and peaks to create a bit of assembly language in order to access the I/O ports on the ZX81. So by now, I was having to learn a bit of assembly language. Tried writing some stuff in BASIC to control it and couldn't get it very accurate. So pretty much had to learn assembly language to make it faster. Learned that from the back of the ZX81 manual, and a copy of eventually invested in was the Rodney Zach's programming book for Z80, and really just literally hand, like we'd done with probably the Cecil education was a good one, it hand assembling, writing out the same, putting the hex codes next to it, working those out in decimal, poking them into memory and running them. So that education had already stood me in good stead to move forward on assembly language. So that was really what drove it, was that project, I suppose, in school, and writing little games like making Space Invaders. And there wasn't a lot of software to buy for the ZX81. I had a few tape. I only had a 1K memory to start with. Eventually invested in a 16K memory pack, and there was, I think, eventually managed to get an assembler for it as well, monitor at first, but then an assembler, so you could type it in as mnemonic code, so you didn't have to remember every code and hand us, especially jumps. I could never get jumps right in assembly language. I don't know if you know the way it works, but I could never get jumps right. Always struggled with them, because you have to use a number, obviously, between 1 and 255, or 0 and 255, but the numbers above 128 are negative numbers, really, to his compliment. I could never get the reverse numbers right. So I always have to put like 4 zeros in, which are NOP instructions, which means do nothing, and have a number that was slightly bigger than it needed to be, because I knew I'd get somewhere behind that instruction and land somewhere. I never could work out exactly. So once I got an assembler, it'd be brilliant. I'm sure that, considering I was in M1, it would be embarrassing, but it did work, which is why if you ever look at any of my old code, there'll be a couple of NOPs and you don't know why.
that article you mentioned sounded interesting as well, the running a nuclear power station off a ZX81. You wouldn't want a RAMPAC wobble in that scenario?
No, absolutely not. You really, really wouldn't. I would certainly not have chanced it. But it was a very capable machine. It just had everything you needed. It was a proper computer. There's no two ways about it. And with a couple of electronics hooked onto it, it was the Arduino of its time. If you wanted to use it that way, there's no two ways about it. As had been its predecessors, and that was the market, the Science of Cambridge, that predated Sinclair were selling to with their MK14. And they were selling to this sort of electronics crossover enthusiast area. And I don't think it was any accident that the MK14 was advertised in Practical Wireless rather than in an electronics magazine. They knew the market they would be hitting would be people converting from radio. I mean, electronics was an emergent thing in the 70s. Prior to that, there was only radio. You didn't have electronics enthusiasts, you had radio enthusiasts. So, again, it was a symptom of that, and I think Clive was quite clever in his letting Chris put that in Practical Wireless. A whole area that had never really had anything to do with computing was suddenly introduced to a machine that they could get into. So, there was the early stages were driven by that company. They really did.
Well, what software titles really stood out to you? And were you playing stuff like Scott Adams games? And what did you want to emulate?
Right. I suppose the games that, in terms of adventure games, my first contact, obviously, on the Alpha, I had probably had a crack at Colossal Cave in college, but it would have had limited time to access that. On the ZX81, obviously, it was the Arctic Adventures, which would have been Planet of Death, and those games. They were the ones that were the first contact with adventure games on the ZX81. I didn't really get into adventure gaming until the Spectrum. And that was sort of Abasoft's, the chance to play Colossal Cave, at home. In terms of the Scott Adams ones, I had very little contact with it because Adventureland obviously came out on the Spectrum, but I didn't really get a copy of that until actually quite recently. I bought a copy a couple of years ago to play it. So that area of Scott Adams' work completely escaped me, purely because I didn't have those sort of machines to access it. You know, it was very much produced on the Apples and the other machines. It came to the Sinclairs much later, certainly the Spectrum side. So. Infocom ones, definitely. By the time the Infocom had come around, I had a Commodore 64. You know, we were already sort of trading as a company by then, so I had access to more machines, and that access to disk drives opened up some of those gaming areas that were just closed to tape-based systems. So in terms of adventures, the Arctic ones were definitely the ones that got me into text adventures, and why I actually knew what they were when Graham wandered down the path, which I'm sure we'll come on to.
Well, like many other kind of Britsoft companies, you started your own software house, Gilsoft, but uniquely you were quite young. How old were you when you actually started Gilsoft?
I'm trying to think. Probably 16, I would have thought. Yeah, it would have been 1981, late 81, that we started selling Cecil, which is probably where it became a commercial thing of selling it. So yeah, that would have been 16, I suppose. So yeah, you're quite young. It just seemed a natural progression. Like I said, Dad always had a bit of a side hobby. We were selling these doorbells. You know, any poor salesman who came to the door to try and sell anything usually went away with a pack of 10 of them as a sailor returned to try and sell to other people they called at the door of. I was in the attic soldering them together. So there was always a bit of an entrepreneurial spirit from my dad, and I think he saw the opportunity to make some money on the software as well. You know, probably more so than I did. It was just for writing it, really. So, like you say, I had all the classic games, obviously, on the ZX81, never left my sight, but I was more into the programming and the creation than playing the games, although, you know, obviously I had a real copy of Monster Maze, everyone did. I'd actually seen that sort of 3D game much earlier, which had inspired what computers could achieve. There was a computer that the Electronics Today International published called the Triton, and that actually had a basic 3D game on it. They published the pictures in the magazines. And I was just amazed that computers might be able to do that sort of thing. So when you saw it on the ZX81, you were just blown away with the graphics. And it was amazing. I mean, it's hard for anybody today who's used to modern graphics to understand what a moment it was to see that 3D graphics could be done on a computer in the late 70s. And then that, you know, you could have one in your house that played this game loaded from a cassette tape. You know, it's just unbelievable. And I still jump when Rex gets me. It's a great one. So
I think that is pretty, he's probably the most terrifying video game character, I think.
Yeah.
Because it's that sense of, you know he's coming.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the little messages that pop up on the screen. Yeah. It's like, oh God.
Yeah, it's what aliens tapped into, isn't it? It's the unseen threat, and yet when you see it at the last second, it is quite a terrifying bit of graphic. And those teeth at that angle, it's just terrifying. Yeah, it's brilliant. It's a good game. So there's no two ways about it. But Mazogs was another favourite of mine on the ZX81 as well. I loved that game. That was really clever. And that's probably moving more into the sort of, you know, exploring, get the sword, move around, definitely sort of onto the adventure side of it, I think, but graphical adventure rather than text, you know.
So. And you're also poking around with code and Kempston joysticks. What's the story there, and how did that help the company grow?
Oh, right. Well, that was sort of a bit of a double-edged sword. That was how I ended up leaving school, of course, early. Because obviously I was programming fairly heavily, and I bought a couple of games, Penetrator, Horace Go Skiing, and a few others for the Spectrum in the early days. And of course, you couldn't use the Kempston joystick with it, which I'd bought. And I was thinking, why can't I use the Kempston joystick with these? And I was quite into sort of having a little look at cracking the games. And I just got involved one Friday afternoon and sort of thought, well, maybe I can adapt it to make the joystick work instead of the keyboard. And I just spent all weekend, you know, the typical programmer in the flow, early hours of Saturday morning, 7 a.m., still tired, get an hour's sleep, have another go at it, keep going all weekend. And by the end of the weekend, I'd adapted about six games. I can't remember what they all were, to be able to use a joystick. And the way I did it was you had a little program that you loaded first, and then you loaded the main game tape, and it stayed in memory somewhere safe, then patched the way the keyboard was read so you could use the joystick, and you could play those games with joysticks. So we added that to the repertoire of Gilsoft sales and called it SoftLink. And it sold quite well, actually, enough that it came to the notice of Kempston pretty quickly. and they asked whether they could sell it with the joystick. You know, came to an arrangement, and they said, you know, we'll buy all your existing stocks, or it's not available from anyone else. And I think I've told this tale to other people. You know, Dad, quick as a flash, they said, how many copies you got? They said, oh, 200. So they bought them off as a retail value. It literally took us a whole week to make those 200 stock.
Good job we didn't say 2,000.
Yeah, no, I was thinking that, actually. But, you know, it was a really, it was quite a lucrative little deal. You know, I mean, it was a couple of thousand pounds for a weekend's work. You know, I can't remember the exact figure now. It's lost in the mist of time. But I think we did some others, and they took the idea and did a few more until the software houses got into including joystick support for the games. But like I said, that really, that weekend, that Monday morning, I got summoned to the school and discussed perhaps about my attendance. They sort of cottoned on as well that I wasn't always spending my time at college, because of course I was splitting my A-level time between college and the school, and they sort of cottoned on that I wasn't really attending the college when I wasn't in school, that maybe I was going home and programming. And by then we were turning over some money on the Gilsoft, so it was they sort of said this wasn't conducive to the school's ethos, and I said it wasn't conducive to me staying, and I walked out to the cheers of applause of the sixth form, who happened to have the open door next to the sixth form tutor's office. But probably one of the worst decisions of my life, but also the best, because obviously I went full time with Gilsoft then. I kept up the college bit with the computing, but I jacked the school in. And on reflection, it was you know, the usual teenager brash. But my dad was very supportive. Said, "If that's what you want to do, and we'll make it work somehow." So, you know, it really got us off onto a full time programmer for the company then.
And you know, it was a real family business as well. I mean, was it just you and your dad, or did you like rope in other family members and get friends helping out?
Everybody. The early covers were drawn by friends from school. Steve Harbron, you know, Hugh Jones did a lot of the loading graphics we did. My mum did all the secretarial and admin work. As we got bigger, we roped in my aunt to do the packing, and my uncle and my cousin did the accounts for us, as you know, obviously we had being qualified accountants. You know, another friend, Andy Morton, did a lot of the testing with us and helped us to do the coding. We, you know, there's no end. I'd be struggling to remember everybody, I suppose. But yeah, we were open anybody we could. So the early artwork was certainly done by school friends in the art class, and you know, they were really good for what they provided for us, and you know, they got us off the ground as well. So yeah, we roped in anybody we could find really to keep the business moving.
Well, you also created a game called Munch Man, very similar to a round friend that we know. What did Atari have to say about this?
All I remember was the Atari headed letter and the sudden destruction of all copies, and well, that was a bit of a bad move on it. I had actually been brought up on copyright issues as in school as well once, because we used to produce a little school magazine, an underground one, and of course I was nicking cartoons from newspapers and magazines and reprinting them as part of the underground magazine. So I was sort of aware of the sort of copyright issues, and it wasn't a surprise that we got pinned down. I think it was just a bit of early enthusiasm to get an advert out. I'd written a Munch Man clone, you know, as part of the effort. So it was included in the things we initially put in the advert, but we re-pulled the advert pretty quick and stopped doing that. And I think it was the last brush we ever had with it. But and looking back on it, it was probably a bad move in the first place, but because it was pretty close. Which it was recently rediscovered though, and we found out, I did find an original copy in the attic, and one of the guys from Crash managed to recover it for us, and it was there was a little news item in the Crash annual the year before last on its recovery. So I thought it'd been lost to time, but there we go. I finally got to see it running again. So I don't think Atari had too much to worry about, really.
I think copyright didn't exist back then until you copied something big.
Yes, absolutely. So luckily enough, we learned our lesson early.
You know, it's interesting though, because obviously you had like Jelly Monsters on the VIC-20, and there was a Snapper on the BBC Micro and the Electron. I think if you just changed just enough of it, you could get away with it, but it must have been a very fine line.
Yeah, I think so. I think describing as Munch Man and describing the dot, probably the description in the advert was pretty much a giveaway, wasn't it?
Well, what was your first commercial game then, and how did you go about selling it back then?
It was 3D Mazer Gold, which is obviously inspired by, talking about copyright, was obviously inspired by Monster Maze to an extent, but it was also inspired by this program I'd seen on the Triton before. That was the one, really, that I was quite proud of, because it used a little bit of a trick for the Spectrum to give you like a real-time walk through the maze. And that was done by using just updating the attributes rather than the actual graphics. For anyone who knows the Spectrum well enough, there's quite a high-resolution 6,000-pixel screen, but then the colours can only be done on this, which gives the classic colour clash. It can only be done on this 24 by 32 grid of colours. So by basically pre-drawing the maze on the 3D view on the screen, I just coloured in the blocks in the 24 by 32 coloured blocks to change the walls and the tie. I was really proud of that at the time. I'd come up with this idea, and it was it turned into a game. You know, you have to collect gold bars before they devalue to find the maze. So it was more the technical trick that led to the game, but that was the first one that said we could probably make some money on this. And that was pretty shortly after the Spectrum was launched, because I was at the microfair in London when it was launched, when the Spectrum was launched, and I phoned my dad and said, look, this is the machine that we could really write software to make money on. I think we need to get one quickly. And I think he actually rang Sinclair while I was at the show with his access card and ordered one. Obviously, they took months to arrive. The show was in April, I think, of 82. So we had ours by about June, July. So we were pretty lucky, really, to get it fairly early. But I'd already read everything I could on it and done some routines on the ZX81. And I come up with this idea. And so we did Munchman, we did the 3D Mazer Gold. We had a version that used a similar attribute update of the life simulation, the cellular automata. That was another one that was included in the advert. I can't remember what the fourth one was. Oh, Cecil, probably, as the educational language. So that was the one, and I think it was in Your Computing in October 1982-ish, which would have come out in the September. We put an eighth-page ad in there, which would stand out. And sort of that was it. That was the commercial launch, really, of Gilsoft in at that time, I think. But I think we also did a few computer shows as well. There was one in Bristol and one in Cardiff, and we had a stand there and sold the software that way as well. So any route we could find, you know. I think we pretty much did that. That was the early days of everybody. It was by mail order in the back of the magazines, because that's all there was. You know, if you look at that particular issue of Your Computing, there was very few adverts for Spectrum software in there, just a handful. You know, we were one of the first in there.
Well, arcade-style games were hugely popular there. Why did you choose to focus on adventure games, and where did the idea of the Quill come from? And please explain it for people who might not actually know what the Quill is.
Yeah, absolutely, of course. Arcade games. Well, I love playing arcade games, but I probably didn't think I was a good enough coder to write one. I did have a crack, but it was more a technical demonstration I could do it, and it never got sold through Gilsoft. It got sold through another company because it really wasn't that good. But it proved I could do sprites and animation and things like that. But by then, the Graham had walked down the drive, because we were obviously operating out of Gilsoft headquarters at this time was 30 Hawthorne Road, which is the family home. So we had a desk in the front bedroom, which is my bedroom, and this guy comes sauntering down the drive. Now, I'd only ever seen black and white photographs of Clive Sinclair, so I didn't know he had ginger hair at the time. So this guy walks down looking very much like Clive Sinclair, but with black hair. And I thought, crumbs, Clive Sinclair's arrived at the house, because I'm looking out of my bedroom window and the doorbell goes, and it's Graham Yandel. And he's seen the advert for Sinclair software, Spectrum software. He thought he'd like to come and see it first before he bought it. Of course, he didn't have a shop you could go and buy to. So he said, oh, fine. So he came up, and he must have been impressed, because apparently he did buy some software, I think made of gold. And went away. But as a sort of parting thing, he said, I've been writing some computer adventure games as well for the Spectrum. I said, oh, have you? He said, yeah, I got this one, Magic Castle. I said, oh, I'd really like to see that. You know, maybe we could sell it if it's any good. And he said, oh, okay. So he supplied me with a copy of this game. And it was brilliant. But it came with, and what he'd had was a method to write computer adventure games for the Spectrum much more simply. And the reality is any kind of game in BASIC is going to be quite slow and going to struggle. And this one allowed you to write in assembly language. And he'd based it on an article in Practical Computing in 1980 by a guy called Ken Reed, which had suggested having an interpreter. Now, an interpreter is a way of, it's pretty much a language specifically for adventure games, which is focused around the sort of things that happen in a game, which is to find a verb or a noun, because most early games were only verb and noun. And you would match whether the person had typed in a verb or a noun by looking it up in a table called a vocabulary. And it would allocate the word to be in either a verb or a noun and give it a number. And so if the two numbers would match, you had that specific verb and that noun, like go south or take axe. And if those matched, then you'd have a list of things to do when those two words were matched. And the list of things might be to check whether you were at a particular location and did you have a particular object, you know. And if those things happened, then the action would be taken to either set a flag to do something later in the game or to print a message out to say you've just died of drinking the poison or whatever you needed to do. So it was a very simple language. It could simply be at one, so you're at location one, and if the verb and noun are drink glass, and is the glass poison? Yes. Message, you die. End. So it's very simple to create the sort of things and activities that happen in an adventure game. There's a bit more complexity, obviously, but that's the basis of it. So he created this method to do it, which is basically, for those who know assembly language, was a database. And you had to hand code the database in an assembler, but you could assemble the database and then just stitch it onto the interpreter and it would run it. A bit like typing it in, if you're typing in a BASIC program, I suppose, just a lot more convoluted. So I had a crack at this to write my own game as well, which was called Diamond Trail. And I thoroughly enjoyed writing my own adventure game. But the method was quite cumbersome. There's no two ways about it. And we got chatting. We'd become quite firm friends by now. And I'd even joined his gaming group he was a member of, so to play Dungeons & Dragons. So we had this sort of discussion back and forth. I said, what would be really nice is if you could... we could do something with this method that it was easy for everybody else to use so that you didn't have to know how to do programming or use an assembler. You could just literally type in those things and it would run, a bit like using BASIC.
That's it, exactly. Like, I think before, you know, a lot of titles were coming out that were full games, but this was a game creation game. And
absolutely.
Nowadays, you get stuff like people making versions of games on the Unreal Engine, that they're creating it on lots of different systems. There's an internal PlayStation one called Dreams, but this was really, really early on. And was there an excitement around it from users to be able to actually create their own experiences, but a lot easier than having to learn all of that?
Oh, absolutely. It absolutely exploded onto the scene. I mean, it took us from a little backroom operation. You know, the Quill really was what launched us into being a proper software house. You know, we had to rent premises. The money started coming in, you know, and it really changed us from being a little back bedroom operation into being a proper company, because it got really good reviews, it sold well, and I don't think there was anything on the market like it at all, you know, nothing. Several other types of things came out later, obviously, but I really genuinely think it was the first one available commercially. Subsequent research has turned up a few attempts by people to have done something similar in the past, but then they never really hit the mainstream for one reason or another, because they were on limited environments. Perhaps, as I said, in the late 70s, you know, computing was very much limited to a very small circle of people, and it was this sort of perfect cauldron of the Spectrum making computing popular, selling in their millions, meant there was a market for software and there was a market for people to create their own things. And a lot of people love creating things, but I don't know about you, but if I want to drill a hole, I don't build an electric drill first to drill one. I go to the shop and buy one. So, yeah. And that's the perfect example, you know. If you want to write a story, you can pick a pen up and use a bit of paper. A lot of people invested in a typewriter to do it. But you know, the reality is you don't need that complex a tool to write a story, but you do in order to be able to program a computer adventure game, and you do to be able to write an arcade game as well. And that's why tools like Arcade Game Designer have become so popular over the years, and things like Unity. And these are tools that take all the hard grunt work out of writing a game and put it in the creativity back into the hands of the people who just want to create. You know, we're using Zencastr as an online. We didn't have to write any of this. It gives us the ability to record a quality podcast or radio show without having to invest all the you know, do it all from the ground up. And at least we stand on other people's shoulders. We really do. And that these sort of tools allow you to do that.
I think you make a really good point there. Because, you know, naively, when I was about like 7 or 8 years old, I remember my friend Gary and I, you know, at school on the BBC Micros, were convinced that we had this, you know, great story ideas. We could write a text adventure game, and we tried to do the whole thing in BASIC. And the amount of things, you know, because you didn't know where the player was going to go next and what they'd choose to pick up, and like the whole thing just fell apart. You know, not having an interpreter, we naively believed it'd be so simple to do.
I think there's also an element of in the text adventure that you want to be able to deal with lots of scenarios in one go, and you can. And I think, don't knock your attempts. You probably would have found what you did was you probably tried to shoot too high. Most people do when they create something. They try to make the best they can straight away. And that's not always the easiest thing, because, like you say, you suddenly the level of complexity becomes massive, and you've got to account for every possible scenario. So, you know, some of my favourite games take place in one room.
Were there any complications with like different versions and translations and different platforms?
Oh yeah, Crumbs became a full-time industry moving across different platforms, and obviously it was the Commodore 64 was the next target. That conversion to 6502 was actually done by Graham. It was the next, obviously, biggest selling platform for us. The difficulty was trying to work out which platforms were worth targeting and would sell well. You know, we obviously the number of machines at the time was massive. Even before we had the Quill, one of the first things we did was obviously try and convert the interpreter to other machines. So I did a translation to the Dragon 32, which never got finished. I learned my lesson about backups on that machine by typing it all in one fell swoop one afternoon, and then when I went to hit save, the Dragon locked up and I lost it.
Nightmare.
Yeah, absolutely. I learned about backups very early on in my career. And again, it was laziness because I'd been hand code transcoding it, and I just thought, oh, I can do this by hand. Skipping steps, never a good one. So C64 obviously was the next big one. Before the 64, we'd done the Illustrator as well, which is the graphics add-on to it. I think it was about the same time. So I was working on that when Graham did the 6502 conversion. Very talented coder, Graham. There's no two ways about it. But we were pushed into doing a version for the Oric. We had a visit from a nice Mr. Bruce Everest in his posh BMW in his coat, telling us it was going to be the next big machine, and we should definitely get a version of Quill for that. So I spent quite a few months developing a version of Quill for the Oric Atmos and Oric One. Oh, which is great. I love the machines. They're great. They really are nice little machines for those who haven't played with them. But I don't think he was quite telling the truth. It was going to be the next big thing in the country somehow. I don't think we sold too many of those. We also had someone engaged to do a QL version, because obviously we'd been asked by Sinclair to nip up to Cambridge to see their top secret project. And there's all these people sat on the train with their big jiffy bags, not talking to each other, all knowing what's in each other's bags, but haven't signed an NDA that would make you cry. We couldn't really talk about it, so we'd got somebody, another local guy from Barry, to write a conversion to the QL for us. But I think, you know, it was starting to explode now, so we had interest from overseas. We had a Norwegian company look to do a scan to get the Scandinavian rights and do translations into other languages. So we did a B version of the product. It was all called A, Quill A, up to version A06, I think we had, because we did obviously found bugs, we issued new ones, and that was a service we offered because it's a utility software. And if we got a problem, you've got to allow people to be able to get a fixed version from you. But we did these sort of B series, which were designed to be translated easily. So something we'd missed in the A series, a couple of the messages were always built in, which you can tell the early Quill games, because, you know, the "do you want to play again" messages are all fixed. And that was something we sort of missed the trick on, really. We should have made that customizable. So we did in the B series. And then there was another version in English for C, as called the C series, which allowed you to do that in English. So that was quite a big deal as well with the Norwegian version translated into that. And there were sniffs from America as well, from a company called Codewriter Corporation, and they wanted to do ones for the Apple, and they wanted an Atari version, and I converted the Commodore 64 version to the Atari 400 800. And we gave them the source code then to do the Apple version rather than them doing it, us doing it for them, I think. I'm trying to think what else we did. We recently discovered they did an IBM version as well, which we didn't know existed. Wow. So there's an IBM PC version. They must have completely written that separate to us, because obviously Graham had written, by this time, had switched to a compiler method on with CPM, and the IBM computer we offered a version that ran as a compiler, still had the interpreter, but instead of an editor you actually wrote it as a bit of source code, a bit more like a programming tool, and compiled the game.
I am pleased to hear that you did a Sinclair QL port, because I actually got my hands on a QL recently, and I haven't got much to run on it, so I'll have to track that down.
Yeah, no problem. I don't think it's available online. Drop me a message. Right, I'll send you a copy. It's not a problem.
We've only, oh, great.
No, no Dragon 32 port?
Not of Quill. I've got, and it's a long-term project, and the Dragon community will know I keep promising to do it. And the Dragon user, there's still an active Dragon community, and we had a day at the Computer Museum about 2 years. I did tease a version of the interpreter running. So it's one of my little retro projects. I need to go back, because I've actually got the stickers for the cassette tapes for Diamond Trail and Magic Castle for the Dragon. We got as far as producing the cassette labels and everything. We just never actually finished the port, and obviously by then the poor old Dragon, the Welsh computer sort of was already being discontinued by then. So we didn't pursue it. It was actually used as our office machine. Now, we had a Secosha dot matrix printer, which was used to print a lot of the documentation. So if you've got any very early versions of our software, it will have been printed on our Secosha on the Dragon. No word processor on it. I taught my mum how to do 10 print and then put in quotes what she wanted to say. So she was basically a word processor, was the basic editor with print statements on it.
Wow.
Yeah. So, yeah, you needs must in the early technology days.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
And he had a proper keyboard, which was actually usable. It was a lovely machine. So,
when you started receiving titles that were made on the Quill, it must have kind of felt a bit like validation for creating the system. And were there particular titles that you really enjoyed? And also, how much did piracy affect Gilsoft?
Right. There's a couple of questions there, isn't there? I think that conversation we had back to with Graham about, wouldn't it be nice to have this sort of program where other people could do it? And he just turned up with this sort of editor, which was so easy to use. And I remember the conversation. He said, well, I don't know, you might be right, but I couldn't see us selling more than 100 or 200 copies, really. I can't see that many people would be interested. And I don't think he, I mean, I was young. I thought everything was going to sell a million copies, you know. But I felt that it was really something that would do well. And so, yes, I suppose seeing people writing games with it was a massive vote for the belief we'd had in the product and the money we'd poured into it as well, because obviously we'd moved from this, you know, the early design drawn by a school friend to have a, you know, professional bit of artwork drawn and what I thought was some beautiful packaging developed for this to stand out on the shelves of Smiths and things as the, you know, and shops, and it was a really nicely presented package. And to actually see people using it was brilliant, especially when you started to see commercial games being written with it as well that was also selling well. You know, things like Dennis with the Drinking Glass, you had Hampstead, the people were produced, and obviously all the Delta IV games, they were my favourite. I loved the humour that Fergus put into his games. It was just great fun. Border of the Rings was a brilliant game, you know. So there's a real they were a real advert for our product. There's no two ways about it. Their ability to commercialize a really good game as well helped to sell the Quill, because, you know, it's a natural snowball. People see, oh, I can actually sell a commercial game with this. And you could, yeah, because again, it's content's king. It's not really the tool that's doing the work. It's taking some of the drudgery out of it, but it's still you who's creating the game. So I think that was, to answer the first question, that is, yes, it was. And it obviously proved to Graham, along with his royalty checks, which were quite significant at the time, I think, probably more than his main job. So, you know, that certainly validated it. There's no two ways about it. And it was great. In terms of games that we were sent, they were obviously highly varied in quality. But, you know, the ones that did come in that we really did, we had a lot of evaluation sheets, and a few of us had give the games a go, and anything we really liked, we started to look at marketing ourselves, which led to the gold collection of some key ones. And there were some really clever ones in that set, I think. Mindbender and Spyplane was a really unusual take on it. It's a sort of mission flyover. I haven't seen anything similar to it till recently, one in the adventure on Game Jam, where there was a Bowerbird one where you've got a, I won't give it away if anyone hasn't played it, but it's quite a clever idea and a technique to be a bird. And I'll give you one little hint. I mean, you know, birds can fly, and there's ups and downs to trees, but it's great fun. This concept of doing something totally different with the genre was there in that game. Devil's Island was a great one. And some of the ones like Madcap Manor, which we sold outside of the gold collection, were really deserving of a full price title. You know, they were just great fun games to play. You know, and it gave that sort of feeling of wandering around a mysterious manor, and it gave you that sense. I think you touched on it earlier. There's so many things the player could do, and I've always thought that the reason adventure games are so appealing is you've no idea how much is in the game. You have to explore it. You've got no sense. You are completely at the... All you see is this sort of, I suppose you call it the fog of war in a war game. You only see the bits you've already seen as the map emerges. So the possibilities are endless in it, because you just... It's the limit of how you can imagine and move forward.
And it's very satisfying when you do something and you discover it and you think, oh, I didn't know I could do that, or I didn't know I could go there. And,
yeah. Oh, people doing things with the Quill, just unbelievable, you know? Yeah. What they could make it do was way beyond anything we thought it could do. You know, all the games, we if you look back at what we did, they were all very, you know, traditional, you know, in a castle, there's a princess, you rescue it, Diamond Trail with, we get a jewel from, the St. Clive Diamond. It was very boring stuff, really, just to prove the technology worked almost. But you could, to see other people really making it sing and dance, just made the tool worthwhile. And really, the original idea from Ken Reed, clever, you know?
Well, obviously, you didn't rest on your laurels. I mean, you came out with Professional Adventure Writer and then the Illustrator as well, which added graphics as well. I mean, how did you kind of improve upon the Quill with these products then? And what was kind of the reaction to those?
Well, the Quill was a natural progression, I think, because obviously people wanted to add graphics like they'd seen in The Hobbit and some of the games that were starting to appear. I mean, The Hobbit was a very early adopter of graphics. Slow as they were impressive. Graham was never a big fan of the graphic side of it, which is why I turned my hand to the Illustrator fairly quickly so that people could add their graphics to the game. That was my thing. I thought from a commercial point of view, we needed to have our tool able to add graphics for people. And I'd also watched, my friends, Hugh, the way he drew, and it was just little subtle movements of line would create an image that was visible. And I thought, well, that's got to be easy to do just that way to capture it. And you sort of had the background of the way these stored graphics will work. So the Professional Adventure Writer was really a way to bring it back to the simplicity, because we'd already launched other add-ons as well that had been submitted by people like Phil Wade had done the press for us. And we had a character design program, so you could do custom fonts. But we were moving away from this simplicity that you just had one program to do everything. It was your environment to develop. So as you'd call it, an IDE today in modern development environment, where you could do everything all in the one package and then test it straight away and go back out to get that immediacy. So Paul was needed to bring those back together, to put Illustrator, the press, the characters editor all into one product, and to make use of micro drives and disk drives to be able to create bigger games to use the 128K of memory of the Spectrum 128 as it was then. We needed an overhaul. We'd done quite well with it. Quillustrator, it was codenamed, of course, initially. I've got a photograph somewhere of a screenshot of it. But it was madly accelerated by the launch of GAC, obviously. Suddenly we had competition in the market, so we had to get it out quick. And it was that, just about making it dead simple for people to carry on and develop software all in this environment where they didn't have to work too hard.
You're involved with the ZX Spectrum Next as well, aren't you?
I am, yes. Yeah. It was pretty much a bit of an accident, really. I'd sort of started reading a little bit about retro computing after I'd been bought one of these Spectrum recreated Bluetooth keyboards as a Christmas present. And I'd found out, I thought, some of my old tapes running out. I wouldn't mind playing 3D Mesa Gold again. I'd gone online and found out this massive community had kept the Spectrum alive. And indeed other retro computing, and it was a massive discovery of what was already there. I didn't have to recover it. I could just download my own game and play it on an emulator. And through that, reading around the topic, I came across the project for the Next and started following it enthusiastically, thinking, oh, that would, you know, that looks really promising to have. Obviously bought myself a few other Spectrum peripherals, modern ones like the SD card interfaces, and I got back into the sort of discovery and that. And the Next team were very interactive. I can't remember how I ended up getting heavily involved in the actual Next itself. You know, somehow I was chatting to the developer of the Next ZXOS, and it was there was a problem with the real-time clock. And again, this sort of speaks to my interest in electronics, I suppose, that I've never really lost that, always like playing about with it. And ESXDOS, which is the operating system you get on Spectrums for the SD card interface, has an ability to load a real-time clock so you can keep time and date stamp the files when you're saving and loading. It's not very well off supported on many of the devices, but it has to fit in 256 bytes. So the Next team had adopted this because they tried to pull in the best of everything that's happened in the retro community. And it only did the date, not the time. And I got a chat and said, oh, I expect I could make that fit in 256 bytes. I'm sure I could improve the driver on that. And I really got back into Z80 coding and thought, oh, this is fun, you know, having to optimize it down and get it working. And sure enough, by the end of the fortnight, whatever, having to play with it and got my oscilloscope out again to be able to look at the signals. I thought, oh, that's why it doesn't work. And really got involved with them and joined the chat and just really started to get enthusiastic about it. And obviously they were looking for people to help work on the network drivers for the ESP chip that was in there as well. So I started moving on to that as well. And just really, they're a great group of guys, and it's a great machine to develop for. It brings back that moment when you feel the machine in your hands. And even in the early days with just the dev board, which I was lucky, obviously I backed the Kickstarter and got a dev board fairly early to work on all this. Even that in its repro case felt like a real Spectrum, and it always did. It brought back that moment of having my Spectrum originally from Sinclair. It gave that moment of excitement and the sense of familiarity and an escape from the modern world. You know, it's computing today is incredibly complicated. You can't do much without having to read, you know, acres and acres of documentation for highly complex APIs to write a program. And the Spectrum allowed you to really code down at the hardware level immediately. And I really enjoyed that. And I just rediscovered what was the joy of computing in 1980, probably 1981. So that's why, you know, I still love playing with it now. You know, it is just a great little machine.
You know, before when you mentioned that sense of anticipation you had when the original Spectrum, when you ordered it and had to wait for it to be delivered. When you said that, I instantly thought, because I've actually backed the recent Kickstarter for the Spectrum Next, and I thought, I'm feeling like that now, waiting to get my machine when it arrives.
Yeah, wait till you hold it in your hands. It's going to be just that first moment, exactly the same again, I promise you.
Well, Tim, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you on this week's show and get your stories. And I can't wait to see what you're going to be doing with the next one. I get my hands on one, hopefully very soon. Of course, we'll link up your website as well. I mean, we could do a whole episode about the Bywood Scrumpy as well, which is really interesting. So I'll put a link to that and obviously everything else that we've talked about in our show notes. But really appreciate you coming on, Tim. Thank you for being our guest this week.
Oh, it's been a real pleasure. Is it over already? Wow.
Time flies when you're having fun.
It does indeed. And that's part of what we should all be doing is enjoying this, isn't it? Because it's a great sense of joy for everybody, and everyone's enjoying it. You know, it's something you can do and feel great about. So, anyway, thanks, guys.
Did you know that many products for pregnant women do not have their own clinical trials for safety or efficacy? That's because pregnant women are often excluded from clinical studies. Ritual is aiming to set a new standard with their essential prenatal multivitamin. It's the number one best-selling prenatal and the only leading prenatal backed by its own human clinical trial. Essential Prenatal is proven to deliver key nutrients, including folate, biotin, and vitamin D during pregnancy. Moms taking Essential Prenatal had a lower overall cortisol level during pregnancy than those taking a leading prenatal. Plus, it's designed to be gentle on the stomach. Ritual doesn't just have your back. They have the receipts. Get 25% off at ritual.com/clinical. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.